She's wrapped in plastic and there's blood going from the front door. It looks like someone started trying to clear it up.
Definitely no one left in the house, yeah?
There's no one else in the house.
It was a quiet morning in the small village of Llantwit Fadre in Wales on the 21st of November 2021. Abigail Fox Roberts had become concerned after she couldn't reach her mother, June, on the phone. She decided to drive over to her home, but as soon as she entered, it became obvious that something was amiss. In the hallway, there was a trail of blood that led Abigail right into the dining room. Pontypridd is a charming town nestled in the county borough of Rhondda-Cynon-Taf in Wales. It boasts a picturesque setting in the South Wales valleys. Its serene beauty is accentuated by the surrounding hilly landscapes and the meandering River Taf, making it an ideal place to call home. Conveniently located just 12 miles away from the bustling city of Cardiff, Pontypridd has earned its reputation as a favoured commuter town. With a history dating back to Roman times, the town has grown and flourished, especially during the Industrial Revolution, when it emerged as a significant centre for coal mining and iron production. Near Pontypridd stands the quaint village of Llantwit Fadre, offering all the essential amenities one might need. On the outskirts of the village lies St Anne's Drive, a residential neighbourhood consisting of detached and semi-detached homes. Some of these residents are fortunate to back onto lush woodlands, and the community centre is just a stone's throw away, fostering a close-knit sense of community. In 2021, 65-year-old June Fox Roberts was proud to call St Anne's Drive her home. For an impressive 4 decades, June had resided in her pebble-dashed, £200,000 detached home, cherishing the fond memories made here. This house was where she and her late husband, Martin, had raised 3 of their children, Tricia, Sebastian, and Abigail. Tragically, the family had faced a loss when Martin, the father of the 3 children, took his own life in 2009 after riding his bicycle over cliffs in Cornwall. An inquest revealed the verdict of suicide, as Martin had expressed a desire to fly away to some individuals. Despite the pain of their loss, June remained resilient and instilled in her children the wisdom to make the most out of life's every opportunity. June was not only an IT consultant, but also a highly successful entrepreneur who ran several family-owned companies from the comfort of her own home. Her renowned baking skills led her to run a bakery nearby, leaving a lasting impression on her customers, such as Coon Trask, who recalled, "She was an amazing baker and did amazing cakes. She was very traditional and would never use a microwave. She was liked by everyone." June was very well liked within the close-knit community, and she was well respected by all those she met. As her daughter Abigail fondly recalled, "Once you met her, you never forgot her. She had taught her children to make the best out of every situation because they only had one life." She had a deep compassion for those around her, and she had a lot of heart, always helping out anybody who was ever in need. At 65 years old, June was eagerly anticipating her retirement. Among the things she looked forward to most were the precious moments she would spend with her children and grandchildren. She couldn't wait to fill her days up baking and tending to her garden. She also looked forward to spending some time with her German shepherd, Aggie, who was her faithful best friend. After living a very eventful life, June had ambitions to write a book, sharing her journey and her bumps along the way. On the morning of the 21st of November 2021, Abigail made several attempts to contact her mother, June. To her dismay, however, all of her calls went unanswered, leaving her with a growing sense of unease. It was highly unusual for her mother not to pick up the phone, prompting Abigail to take immediate action. Concerned for her mother's well-being, she hurried over to St. Anne's Drive to check on her. With her key in hand, Abigail unlocked the front door and stepped inside. To her shock, she noticed a trail of blood leading from the entrance into the dining room. Fear gripped Abigail as she called out to her mother, but her pleas echoed without a response. Aggie, her mother's faithful German shepherd, made an appearance, but even her presence couldn't alleviate Abigail's growing dread. Fearing the worst, Abigail followed the trail of blood. In the dining room, her eyes fixated on something in the middle of the floor. There, on the ground, she came across a horrifying sight. A bloody human torso lying on top of a blue tarpaulin. Adjacent to it was a chainsaw. Abigail fled from her mother's home and immediately dialed 999, summoning the police.
Tobias, police, what's the emergency?
I've just come home and I found my mother's body in the dining room. She's wrapped in plastic and there's blood going from the front door. It looks like someone started trying to clear it up.
Definitely no one left in the house, yeah?
There's no one else in the house. The house is empty.
Take a deep breath. We're almost with you, okay? I've got officers coming over as an emergency response, okay?
Detectives swiftly arrived on the scene and guided Abigail to safety outside. Pale and trembling, she identified the torso as her mother, June's. With the initial priority of securing the premises, detectives carefully searched every room to ensure that there were no other potential threats.
Where is she? Living room. What is this? Whoever it is, try cleaning it up. There's a couple of footprints in there, blood.
Yeah, code blue appears as a body in the living room.
In the dining room, they discovered evidence of an attempt to clean up the crime scene. Bleach had been splattered on the floor, and nearby there was a bag of cleaning products and blood-stained gloves. The crime scene was cordoned off with yellow tape, encompassing not only the home but also the surrounding grounds, including the entrances to the woodland behind the home and near the community centre. As forensic experts conducted their inquiries at home, detectives embarked on door-to-door interviews with all of June's neighbours. They hoped to find any leads or potential witnesses who may have seen or heard something suspicious. Nightfall had descended on the neighbourhood, intensifying the urgency to apprehend a suspect and locate the missing parts of June's body. There was a growing fear that some unsuspecting passerby may stumble upon the gruesome evidence, leaving them scarred for life. Perplexing the detectives was the perpetrator's decision to take most of June's body, leaving behind evidence of an attempt to clean up the home. Speculation arose that the killer intended to return and dispose of June's torso as well, but Abigail's discovery had thwarted their plans. However, detectives needed to wait until the following morning to continue their search, with the assistance of daylight. The next morning, they returned to the home, and as they continued, June's children paid tribute to her. They referred to her as a kind-hearted, generous mother who was never happier than when she was surrounded by friends and family. They commented, "We are in utter shock about the death of our mother. Her murder will never make sense to us. She loved her family deeply, and we will never be the same. We're heartbroken." The family also asked the public to respect their privacy and allow them to grieve and come to terms with what had happened in peace. The family was among the first to be interviewed by detectives, who were hoping to shed some light on any potential motives or enemies who may have posed a threat to June. However, all accounts pointed to June being cherished and admired by everybody who knew her, leaving the unsettling possibility that she might have fallen victim to a random attack. This theory reverberated through the small village, leaving the community on edge. In response to their growing concerns, detectives increased their presence in the area the following morning, patrolling the streets in police cars in an effort to reassure the residents. They also made a public appeal urging anybody with any information about June's murder, or anybody who may have witnessed suspicious activity in the village, to come forward. To intensify the investigation, around 50 detectives, including specialists, were assembled to work tirelessly in their pursuit of unravelling the mystery behind June's tragic fate. Setting up an incident room at the police station, the detectives wasted no time and swiftly commenced their investigation the next morning. With the aid of sniffer dogs, they meticulously combed through the vast fields adjacent to June's home. But unfortunately, no significant clues or the rest of June's body was uncovered. In their quest to trace a potential suspect, detectives turned their attention to surveillance footage in the neighbourhood. There were no local surveillance cameras, so they sought help from the residents. Some of June's neighbours had Ring doorbell cameras, and the detectives meticulously reviewed this footage, hoping to catch a lead. However, despite their efforts, the Ring doorbell recordings yield nothing of significance. The investigation at the crime scene continued to unfold, and forensic experts concluded that the initial attack on June occurred in the hallway. This was evident by blood spatters that suggested she had been struck by multiple heavy blows. As they moved through the house, forensic experts noticed spots of blood at the bottom of the stairs to the left of the hallway. In the dining room, where June's torso was discovered, they found a large puddle of blood adjacent to a cardboard box. Disturbingly, the walls bore traces of human tissue, indicating that this was where June's dismemberment had occurred post-mortem. The brutality of the murder led forensic experts to believe that the killer would have been heavily covered in blood and body tissue. As they continued searching the home, they stumbled upon a Cinderella Christmas bag, thoughtfully bought by June for her granddaughter's Christmas presents. However, upon opening the bag, a horrifying discovery was made. Inside lay one of June's severed legs. Shockingly, several other bags in the dining room contained the rest of June's dismembered body, including her head. Contrary to initial speculation, the killer had not taken away the remains. Instead, they had left them in the dining room. Within these bags, forensic experts also unearthed further evidence. Men's clothing, including a pair of Adidas shorts, a black cap, and a black t-shirt. June's family couldn't account for these items, strongly suggesting they belonged to the killer, who likely changed his clothing after committing the murder. In addition to the forensic evidence, another clue emerged: the discovery of a large bloody footprint, approximately size 11 or 12. Upstairs in the bathroom, a curious finding came to light: a recently used tub of hair dye, along with some hair in the sink. This seemingly insignificant item became another piece of the puzzle that detectives were determined to solve. June's hair hadn't recently been dyed, so a detective speculated that after killing June, her killer had dyed and cut their hair in an effort to conceal their appearance. The presence of a Parker chainsaw near June's body also raised questions, but its connection to the murder remained unclear. Despite its unusual placement, there was no blood on it, suggesting it hadn't been used in the dismemberment. Among the findings, forensic experts discovered a plastic bag near June's remains, containing various cleaning items, including rubber gloves turned inside out and stained with blood. The gloves indicated that the killer had used them while attempting to clean up the crime scene. As June's family confirmed that these cleaning items didn't belong to her, detectives deduced that the killer had brought them along with him. Once June's remains were removed from the dining room, a large blood-stained axe was found underneath the bags. All of the evidence collected from the home was sent for forensic testing, with the hope of obtaining a DNA profile of the perpetrator. Meanwhile, June's remains were transported to the medical examiner's office, where it was found that she had been bludgeoned to death. Amidst the ongoing analysis of evidence, a distressing turn of events unfolded in the small village. Rumours began to circulate, falsely implicating June's daughter Tricia in her own mother's murder. Tricia, who had come out as transgender, had received hurtful messages on social media accusing her of killing her mother. Despite June's wholehearted support of Tricia, the stigma surrounding transgender individuals seemed to fuel these baseless accusations. People on social media shared photographs of Tricia using her dead name and insinuated her alleged involvement, completely ignoring the fact that she had been in Cornwall when her mother was murdered. These rumours deeply devastated Tricia, who loved her mother dearly and was grappling with the loss of her in such a violent manner. Detectives, committed to finding the truth, made a public statement, urging people to stop spreading gossip and allow them to focus on their investigation. Their primary goal was to solve the murder and bring the real perpetrator to justice. As part of their efforts, detectives widened their search for surveillance footage beyond the neighbourhood. Meanwhile, a crucial development emerged when a 999 call came in from a local man working at a nearby tyre yard, located within a 5-minute walk from St. Anne's Drive.
Please, what's your emergency?
Hi, love. We just found the dude, the guy in the yard. He just come out with one of our wagons.
Is he still there now?
Yes.
The caller reported witnessing a dishevelled man emerging from one of the containers at the tyre yard. He was wrapped in a navy blanket, barefoot, and appeared to have scratches on his face. The surveillance footage indicated that the man had entered the container approximately 3 hours after June's body was discovered. Further observations of the man revealed that his hair appeared to have recently been dyed and sloppily cut, with some parts remaining long and others completely bald. He carried a large backpack and a large plastic bag, dressed in a black leather jacket, black jeans and a striped t-shirt. Detectives swiftly descended upon the tire yard after receiving the 999 call, but unfortunately the man spotted on the surveillance footage had already vanished. Despite his absence, detectives carefully reviewed the captured footage. To their interest, they noticed that the man's black leather jacket bore a striking resemblance to one owned by Tricia. Tricia confirmed that both the striped t-shirt and the leather jacket belonged to her.
Just for the benefit of recording, can you just help give us your full name?
Yeah, my name is Tricia Fox.
There's a few questions and we just want to clarify with everything that's been ongoing. We want to show you a couple of things here. It's a selection of stills and photographs taken from some CSI photographs from the investigation. We've got an item of clothing here that I'd like you to have a look at. It's... Do you recognise that?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that your top?
Yeah, that's my top. Yeah, it should be in my room. Why is that top in that jacket?
That's your jacket, is it? Right. Okay.
Drawing connections from this evidence, detectives surmised that this man could be the killer. It seemed likely that he had stolen Trish's clothing after the murder, abandoning his own blood-stained garments with June's dismembered remains. With the aim of identifying the man, detectives released the surveillance footage and sought public assistance in locating him. The man was described as a white man in his 20s or 30s, of thin build and around 5 feet 8 inches tall. He had light blonde moussey hair that was sticking up on the sides with a couple of bald patches. He also had his nose and lip pierced. During their investigation, one name that surfaced was 25-year-old art student Luke Daly, who had recently been reported missing from the area. Luke's parents and the health authorities had raised concerns about his well-being, as he had been struggling with mental health issues and required medication. However, upon comparing the surveillance footage with Luke's known appearance, it became apparent that the man seen emerging from the container did not match Luke's well-presented groomed demeanour. The man in the footage appeared to be quite the opposite in appearance and behaviour. Detectives continued to scan through further surveillance footage at the tire yard, and they found further videos of the unfamiliar man. It was evident that he was living rough, and at times he appeared to be talking to himself. Detectives had already speculated that due to the brutal nature of June's murder and the random nature of it, the killer was somebody that wasn't of sound mind. At one stage, the man also appeared to be talking to his shadow. He rocked back and forth as he chatted to himself. Detectives were convinced more than ever that this man was their killer, but now they just needed to identify him. After the surveillance footage was made public, a helpful tip came in, recounting a recent encounter with a man resembling the one seen in the video. The witness had seen him just the day before June's body was found, and recalled talking to him in a car park behind a row of shops in the village. Detectives swiftly gathered the surveillance footage from the shops, revealing a man wearing black shorts, carrying a backpack and two plastic bags. While examining this footage, another phone call came in from someone who had spotted the same man sitting against a wall behind a row of houses in the village. He was still wearing the leather jacket, black trousers and striped t-shirt, alongside his backpack and plastic bags. Detectives rushed to the scene, hoping to apprehend him before he could flee on foot. Upon arrival, they found the man casually sitting on the ground, his face and hands covered in soot. He seemed unfazed by their presence as he indulged in a packet of Haribo sweets.
What's your name?
Lewis.
Lewis, is it? Right, okay. You are? Have you?
Yeah.
Right. Pop down what you're doing at the moment, right? Stand up for me.
Yep.
Right, just look right. Have you got anything on you shouldn't have now?
I've got like a nunchuck thing.
Right, leave it where it is, yeah. Alright? You put your hands behind your back a second, yeah. Right? Right. Just take your seats off. Right. Bring your hands behind your back. On this one. Yeah. Alright, at the moment, right, you've been arrested on suspicion of murder.
Okay.
Alright? There's been an incident, but I don't know if you're aware of it, but that's what you've been arrested for, right?
Okay.
So you're going to have to say anything, but it may harm your friends. If you do not mind someone questions, something just later in the court.
No worries.
If you do say, maybe you're going to end it. Do you understand? Right. Go on then. Come and jump. We'll grab your stuff now. Come and jump in the back of the van with me in a minute.
Okay.
He told the detectives that his name was Lewis and that he had been on a hike. He was arrested on the spot and informed that he was being arrested on suspicion of murder. Before he was placed in the back of the police van, he said that his surname was Thomas.
Yeah.
Your name is Lewis, is it?
Lewis.
What's your surname?
Thomas.
It's up in the van, right? What's your name? Just get in.
Back at the police station, Lewis Thomas was photographed. It was evident, based on his appearance, that he hadn't slept for some time. He was extremely dishevelled and dirty, and his arms and legs were covered with scratches, as if he had been crawling through bushes. His backpack had some spots that appeared to be blood. If you're a fan of classic mysteries filled with unexpected twists, then June's Journey is the ideal game for you. Step into the world of June Parker, a charming amateur detective, as you embark on a quest to unravel the enigma surrounding her sister's murder and unearth long-concealed family secrets. Prepare to test your powers of observation while exploring over 1,000 meticulously crafted scenes, hunting for concealed clues and critical pieces of information. Immerse yourself in the glamorous 1920s era, where the captivating visuals and immersive gameplay of June's Journey transport you to a bygone time. I've been engrossed in this mobile puzzle game for well over a year now, often losing track of time as I play late into the night as a way to unwind after a busy day. One of the standout features of June's Journey, for me personally, is the opportunity to craft your own island estate, complete with beautiful gardens, and you can even become part of a detective club to play with other sleuths. Can you crack the case? Download June's Journey for free on iOS and Android. With Lewis Thomas now in custody, the investigation continued. And detectives revisited the earlier surveillance footage from outside the car park where the man had been spotted before the murder. Interestingly, the footage presented a perplexing revelation. This man looked remarkably different from the one who had just been arrested. He sported dark hair and a large beard. But still, he carried the same backpack and plastic bags. He was also wearing the Adidas shorts and the black t-shirt. In fact, the man in this footage bore an uncanny resemblance to Luke Daly, the missing art student. The investigation took on a whole new angle when the man's identification confirmed that Lewis Thomas was in fact Luke Daly. He was brought into the interrogation room but refused to speak, other than to say no comment.
Neris is here as the Welsh language interpreter. Obviously we're going to use English, but if there's any issues that you want translated, any words you don't understand, I can either rephrase things or Neris can assist with translation.
Okay.
June was 65. She was a grandmother. She was murdered in her home over the weekend. She's been subjected to a pretty horrific attack. Her head's been cut off, as have both her arms and legs. And her body parts have been put in bags in the living room, and someone has tried to clear up the house. You failed to account for any of your movements over the weekend. How do you explain that?
No comment.
Is that you in the CCTV?
No comment.
And the male there has got what looks like a carrier bag and a black rucksack on his back. Is that you?
No comment.
However, when he was presented with the earlier surveillance footage of him wearing the same shorts found at the crime scene, he asked for a break.
The next thing I need to speak to you about is a pair of black Adidas shorts, which are size medium, with a tear on the left leg.
So, can we take a break? Is that cool?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, bear with me. At Luke's request for a break, we're going to take a pause. It is now 1958 hours, and I'm going to stop the recording.
Following his arrest, Detective Superintendent Darren George made a statement which read, "I would again like to offer my personal thanks to the local community for their support during the investigation. The charging of a 25-year-old local man is quite clearly a significant development in the investigation, and I hope this goes some way in offering reassurance to the local community." As Luke Daly was still being questioned by detectives, the investigation into June's murder continued. Detectives appealed to the public and asked for their assistance in finding her mobile phone. It had been taken from her home following the murder and was described as an iPhone 11 with a red flip case. Detectives speculated that Daly could have dropped it, discarded it, or even sold it. While they searched for June's mobile phone, Daly submitted DNA samples. These were fast-tracked to the lab, where they came back as a match to the DNA found on the blood-stained shorts found in June's dining room. With this new evidence, Daly was brought back for further questioning.
Shorts matching that have been found at June's house. They're in an Asda bag in the living room, and also in that bag is one of June's arms, which has been cut from her body. As I said, those shorts have been forensically examined, and your DNA is on them. How can you explain that?
No comment.
Did you shave your beard, dye your hair, change your clothes in an attempt to get away?
No comment.
Did you subject June to a horrific attack that ended her life and then chopped up her body?
No comment.
If that's not the case, if there's anything you haven't told me that would be relevant, now is your opportunity.
No comment.
On the 26th of November, Luke Daly was charged with June's murder.
Luke, you can come up to the desk for us here, okay?
Okay, look, you're going to be charged with the offence shown below. You do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defence if you do not mention now something which you'll later rely on in court, and anything you do say may be given in evidence. You're being charged that between the 19th of November and the 21st of November of this year, at 49 St Anne's Drive in Llantwit, you murdered June Fox Roberts, contrary to common law.
You're going to apply to me to the court soon?
No comment.
The bail has been denied, and you'll be going to court in the end. But is there anything you want there? Drink, food, or anything like that?
I'd be curious to look at a hot chocolate and pot.
Yeah, sorry.
The next day, he shuffled into court wearing a grey tracksuit and only spoke to confirm his date of birth and address. He appeared in court again via video link just days later, where a provisional trial date was set for the 9th of May, and a plea and trial preparation scheduled for the 17th of March. The trial date was initially postponed until April 2023. However, on the 28th of April 2023, Luke Daly made an appearance in court and entered a guilty plea to the charge of manslaughter in relation to June's death. He cited diminished responsibility as the grounds for his plea. On the other hand, he pleaded not guilty to the murder charge, and the Crown accepted his plea. During the court proceedings, it was revealed that Daly had been suffering from paranoid schizophrenia at the time of the murder, as confirmed by three psychiatric reports concluded after his arrest. These reports indicated that his mental state was significantly impaired, affecting his ability to comprehend the consequences of his actions, exercise self-control, and make rational judgments. As a result of his mental health condition, Luke Daly was sectioned under Section 45 of the Mental Health Act and was remanded to a psychiatric hospital. The sentencing was adjourned until the 28th of April. Luke Daly's descent into madness had been apparent for some time. In March of 2019, he was admitted to a psychiatric hospital for a month due to an acute episode of psychosis. Following this, he was prescribed antipsychotic medication. However, in July 2021, his parents became concerned about his well-being once more and sought help from the community mental health team. During a home visit, Daly disclosed that he had stopped taking his medication, prompting the psychiatrist to provide him with an emergency supply. Later that year, in September of 2021, Daly began attending university in Cardiff and moved into a shared house. His mental health continued to deteriorate, leading to concerning behaviour around his roommates. This included retaining other residents' room keys, playing excessively loud music, and damaging the fire alarm system. On the 11th of November 2021, the situation escalated when Daly directed abusive behaviour towards a female roommate, dousing her with water and using derogatory language.
Surface Peace, how may I help you?
Hi, I'd like to report my housemate for verbal and physical abuse and threatening harm. His name's Luke Daly. Today, he's verbally abused me and threw a cup of water over me and threatened, like, physical violence.
What did he say to you?
Just that I'm a bitch and to, like, I need to learn respect and to watch myself and stuff like that.
Troubled by his actions, the roommate decided to file a complaint with the police and the letting agents, leading to Daly leaving the property abruptly and leaving behind all of his personal belongings. Inside his abandoned bedroom, detectives discovered disturbing drawings with demonic themes, hinting at the depths of his delusional beliefs. Some of these drawings were self-portraits, but with an evil undertone. There were also a number of photographs of nude women that were bound with rope. Daly had become entangled in a web of delusions, firmly convinced that he received messages from a higher power, commanding him to commit a heinous act. These delusions also involved an irrational fear of an unseen group of individuals conspiring against him. After being kicked out of the shared home, Daly chose to live as a transient, and surveillance footage captured him wandering around the area on multiple occasions. On the 18th of November, he was observed near the university campus, attempting to access various stores at the student union. His presence was again documented on the 19th and 20th of November, in the areas of Church Village and Llandudfardra. On the 19th of November, June's daughters were leaving for the weekend, and she was left alone at home. Her daughter Abigail playfully teased her about not throwing a party or causing a ruckus while they were away. Abigail had been living with her mother since her marriage ended, and she felt content knowing her mother would have some peaceful time to herself. However, during the window between the 19th and 20th of November, Luke Daly seized the opportunity and broke into her home through an open window. Armed with an axe, a chainsaw, and cleaning products, Daly encountered June in the hallway, and without mercy, he viciously attacked her. Striking her head with the axe, he callously proceeded to stomp on her as she lay on the ground. The injuries found on June's left arm indicated her desperate attempt at self-defense. Dealey then dragged June into the dining room, where he placed her in a tarpaulin. He then proceeded to decapitate and dismember her, using the axe. Following his arrest, Dealey revealed his disturbing beliefs to the detectives. His mind had become consumed with an unhealthy obsession with Satan and demons. He claimed to have received messages from a supposed higher power, urging him to commit a murder. Tragically, June became an unwitting victim of his delusions, caught in the wrong place at the wrong time, the one place she should have felt safe. During the sentencing on the 29th of April, the harrowing facts of the case were recited in the courtroom. Prosecutors brought to light that leading up to June's tragic murder, Dealey harbored a delusional belief that a group of individuals were out to get him. Psychiatrist Dr. Tom Wine testified in court. He emphasized that Dealey's ability to comprehend the nature of his actions, exercise rational judgment, and maintain self-control had been substantially impaired due to his mental condition. Dr. Wine firmly asserted that Dealey should remain under the care of the high-security Ashworth Hospital, situated near Liverpool. During the proceedings, June's family courageously shared their victim impact statements, highlighting the profound loss that they had endured. Abigail, June's daughter, expressed the haunting and lasting trauma she experienced from discovering her mother dead and dismembered. Tearfully, she revealed, "I close my eyes and I see the tarpaulin, my mother's nightdress. Those images will never leave me." Abigail further lamented that her childhood home, her safe space, was completely destroyed in the most violent way imaginable. She said, "The house that had been the family home since 1985, her safe place, her haven, the place where some of my fondest memories occurred." The emotional toll on Abigail was evident as she disclosed her ongoing struggle with post-traumatic stress disorder. She underwent several rounds of counselling to cope with the trauma, knowing that more support would be necessary in the future. "Someday," she confessed, "the weight of depression and anxiety made it almost impossible for her to muster the strength to rise from her bed in the morning." During her statement, Abigail revealed the profound impact her mother's tragic death had on her life. While searching for a new home, she was gripped with fear, worrying about potential entry points to the house, neighbours' gardens, and the surrounding streets and areas. Tearfully, she confessed, "I'm terrified that something will happen to me and take me away from my daughter. I never want my daughter to have to endure what I've been through." Sharing cherished memories of her mother, Abigail mourned the loss of her rock, emphasizing that she would never again hear her mother's infectious laughter. She continued, stating, "There were so many things I wish she had told me before she was taken away so violently and thoughtlessly. Mum had a difficult life and didn't deserve this." Tricia, in her own victim impact statement, described the moment she learned of her mother's death while she was in Cornwall. The devastating news upended Tricia's world, causing her to abandon her college education and leaving her homeless. The trauma of her mother's murder had profoundly affected her mental well-being, resulting in significant changes to her personality and her way of life. Tricia likened the experience to a twisted horror movie, as if her reality had transformed into a surreal world of fiction. In mitigation, Luke Dealey's defense attorney, Roger Elias, read aloud a heartfelt letter from his parents. It read in part, "The case is disturbing, shocking, and tragic. Our hearts go out to her family. We can only imagine the grief and trauma they're going through. We wake up every day wishing their mother was alive and well." The defense attorney highlighted that Dealey was a completely different person compared to the one who committed the murder. He emphasized that his client was incredibly ill at the time of the murder, which was the only explanation for the dreadful events that unfolded. He said that Dealey wanted to plead guilty to spare June's family the ordeal of a trial. Before handing down Daly's sentence, Judge Mr. Justice Griffith acknowledged Daly's genuine belief in receiving messages from a higher power, instructing him to commit the crime. He also accepted that he had the delusional belief that there were a group of individuals out to get him. Before announcing the sentencing, Judge Mr. Justice Griffith told the courtroom, "This was a brutal killing and dismemberment of a woman after you went into her house at night. I'm satisfied that the most suitable way of dealing with you is under the Mental Health Act, that you are detained at Ashworth High Security Hospital." He said that there was a risk that Daly would commit further serious offences if he weren't detained. He added, "You only did this terrible thing because of your mental illness. You have no previous convictions, and there's no evidence you had any rational motive for what you did." He then ordered that Luke Daly be indefinitely detained in a psychiatric hospital. He will remain there until he is deemed to no longer be a threat to society, if that time ever comes. Over the course of several years, Luke Daly's mental health had been on a troubling decline. At one point, there was a glimmer of hope when antipsychotic medication was introduced, seemingly bringing some improvement. However, as he began his university journey, Daly made the unfortunate decision to discontinue his medication, setting in motion a chain of tragic events that culminated in the murder of June Fox Roberts, a senseless act that shattered the illusion of safety within the confines of one's own home. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say a big, massive thank you to my newest supporter up on Patreon, Kathy. The link to Patreon is in the show notes, so please do feel free to check it out if you'd like to support the show in exchange for bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms, ad-free and early release episodes, behind the scenes, and of course my undying love. If you'd like to support the show in another way, please consider leaving me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you're listening. Ratings and reviews are a super easy way to support an independent show that you like, and I genuinely do appreciate any feedback. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.